All right, I think we're ready. Our next presenter is a very familiar face to ARSC audiences. Dennis D. Rooney has been a member of ARSC since 1986 and served on its technical committee. His reviews of books and recordings regularly appear in the ARSC Journal, and he has been a regular presenter at these conferences. His professional career embraces journalism, classical record production, broadcasting, and narration, a path simultaneously accompanied by nearly six decades as a record collector. He has served the classical recording industry as both a producer and archival and catalog exploitation consultant, highlights of which include his work on the award-winning series of Masterworks Heritage historical reissues for Sony Classical and the 12-CD set of historical and broadcast recordings issued by the Minnesota Orchestra to celebrate its centennial. His writings on music have regularly appeared in the Strat since 1984. He has also contributed to the BBC Music Magazine, Musical Times, Classic Record Collector, and MusicalAmerica.com. In addition to affiliation with Minnesota Public Radio and New York's WQAM, he has recorded more than 100 titles for the Talking Books administered by the Library of Congress's National Library Service for the Blind and Physically Handicapped. It's my pleasure to welcome Dennis Rooney, who will talk on Artur Rudzinski, a reevaluation of his career and discography on the 50th anniversary of his death.
I'm compromising towards the end and until the end. And I think that was one of his greatest assets at the same time, one of his most difficult problems, because he did not get along very well with so many people, so many managements, especially because the demands were such that they were difficult to fulfill. He did not know how to compromise. It was during some of the sessions recording sessions from Westminster in London. I believe the young Grisha was from the Nutcracker, that we were in the playback room and they were just promoting the court list for the producer, or they were just trying to promote and produce the first stereo recordings. And I thought, well, I don't think you're a stereo here at all. So I went up to the two speakers, one to the other, and came back and said, but that, you know, they were good to hear the cellos and basses up here on the right, and the strings clearly on the left, and the percussion. And he said, well, that at night, the stereo means death, I don't hear that. And therefore, I would not let these records go out as stereo with my name on them if they weren't released up without my name. And driving back to the hotel in the car, I thought, what are you saying? Obviously, we would sell many more records, it would be much more easy to promote, and it would be great to have a stereo, but I can't do it. If I just don't believe in something which I don't believe is right, it's correct, it's musically acceptable, I can't have any.
That's Richard Rudzinski recalling his father, the conductor Artur Rudzinski, who died 50 years ago this November, 1958, from heart failure. Look at the two photos behind me and you'll see what the disease wrought in his countenance. The right one shows him in his early 60s, but he looks much older. Rudzinski was a Pole, growing up in Lvov, where early musical studies there continued in Vienna. He returned to Lvov, where he became a repetiteur and coach at the opera there. He was later summoned to Warsaw and conducted both the opera and the Warsaw Philharmonic. In 1925, Leopold Stokowski heard him conduct Die Meistersinger and engaged him as a guest in Philadelphia. The next year, he appointed Rudzinski his assistant. In Philadelphia, Rudzinski also supervised the operatic and orchestra programs at the recently founded Curtis Institute. New York heard him for the first time when he filled in for an indisposed Stokowski. So, in 1943, when he was music director of the New York Philharmonic, he was happy that his 25-year-old assistant, Leonard Bernstein, had the opportunity of taking the place of an ailing Bruno Walter. An assistant conductor does many things, and the first recorded document we have of Rudzinski is as Stokowski's pianist on an outline of themes of the Franck Symphony in D minor. It was recorded at Victor's Camden Studios on the 6th of October, 1927.
This might be called the symphony of the mystical and dream world. It is the expression of a mystic who lived most of life in the cloistered seclusion of the beautiful Gothic church of Saint-Clotilde in Paris, playing the organ and dreaming of other worlds. The first movement begins with a powerful theme. The second theme, played by the violin, is sympathetic and singing. The third theme is triumphant. The end of this moment builds up to an ecstatic climax of thrilling beauty.
Rozhinsky admired Stokowski and was grateful to him, but he never quite believed in the authenticity of his Polish origins or that Polish accent that used to come and go depending on circumstances. In 1929, Rozhinsky left Philadelphia to become conductor of the Los Angeles Philharmonic, where he remained until 1933. There, he began to demonstrate his skill as an orchestra builder. His success led to an invitation in 1933 from the Cleveland Orchestra. He remained with them for a decade and made it one of the most exciting orchestras in the United States. He gave the United States premiere of Shostakovich's opera, The Lady Macbeth of Mtsensk, on the 31st of January, 1935, and scored a major success when he repeated it at New York's Metropolitan Opera House. His work in Cleveland was noticed by Arturo Toscanini, who brought him to Salzburg in 1936. The two are pictured looking at the recently published score of Bartók's Music for Strings, Percussion, and Celesta. The look on the old man's face suggests his comment, "Rozhinsky, it doesn't speak to me." When Toscanini announced his retirement from the New York Philharmonic that same year, Rozhinsky, who had made a successful debut with them the previous year, hoped for the job but didn't get it. However, when Toscanini agreed the following year to lead the NBC Symphony Orchestra, he insisted that Rozhinsky be engaged to audition and train the players. Before Toscanini arrived for his first concert in December 1937, Rozhinsky conducted the orchestra's first radio broadcasts. Midway through the NBC Symphony Orchestra's second season, Rozhinsky made his first commercial recordings as a conductor. On the 2nd of January 1939, he conducted the orchestra in Carnegie Hall, first in the work from which he played piano excerpts almost a dozen years earlier, the Franck Symphony in D minor.
Thank you.
second session of the day, produced this recording of Tchaikovsky's Symphony No. 4. Records which document Roginsky's contribution to the NBC Symphony were made by Victor for a series of low-priced discs sold by the New York Post and other newspapers throughout the country under the label World's Greatest Music. The performers were all anonymous. That same year, Columbia Records, purchased by CBS in 1938, set out to expand and revitalize its catalog by signing up a large number of artists, including the New York Philharmonic, Minneapolis, Pittsburgh, and Cleveland orchestras. A team of engineers under producer Moses Smith journeyed to Severance Hall. Recordings were made on 16-inch lacquer discs at 33 1/3 RPM, with approved takes re-recorded to 78 RPM matrices. One of the very best Cleveland recordings, Rimsky-Korsakov Scheherazade, was made at the first session on the 20th of December, 1939. Columbia engineers favored tight miking and relied too much on post-production to correct balance problems. When they came to record Strauss's Ein Heldenleben at the second session in early 1940, the results, as issued on shellac discs, were as harsh and unresonant as the performance was outstanding, almost the equal of the Mengelberg Victor recording. When Columbia reissued Ein Heldenleben on its budget LP line of the early 50s, Entree, they added reverb by running the audio down a back stairwell at their 7th Avenue studios in Manhattan. It was primitive, but quite successful. Thank you. But Ein Heldenleben was a rare flop in the Cleveland series. Rudzinski quickly acquired a reputation for making distinguished recordings. When, in 1937, he had conducted the NBC Symphony and the American premiere of Shostakovich's Fifth Symphony, it further embellished his reputation as a leading advocate for the composer. Shostakovich's First Symphony had also become something of a Rudzinski specialty, and he recorded it in the spring of 1941. Testament to Rudzinski's productivity in recording for Columbia are the four pages of lab sheets from the 28th, 29th, December 1941 sessions. This is the first of them. At the end of the first day's session, the producer wrote 23 sides in 3 hours, bravo, in red China marker across the bottom of the page. Notice that the second day's yield was only slightly less. Those issued recordings made at the sessions in many cases remained in the Columbia catalog for as long as 20 years. During that golden decade in Cleveland, Rudzinski became an American citizen and bought a farm near Stockbridge, where he began to raise goats. Their milk was supposedly soothing to his stomach. He also fell under the spell of Frank Buckman and the Moral Rearmament Movement, and if you want more information about that, please Google it. In 1943, the ill-starred John Barbaroli left the New York Philharmonic, and it was offered to Rudzinski with the title of music director. Again, Rudzinski rebuilt an orchestra in decline, in the process dismissing 16 players and battling with the management, particularly Arthur Judson, the czar of American concert activity at that time. Due to the first Petrillo band mentioned just before me, recordings could not be made when Rudzinski arrived in New York. However, the Philharmonic broadcast nationwide each week, and this 1944 excerpt from Fives' Three-Cornered Hat suggests that the rebuilding process had gotten well underway. By the end of 1944, recording resumed, and Columbia embarked on a new series of Rudzinski recordings in Carnegie Hall. Columbia had him record the same core repertoire as in Cleveland, but with exciting additions, such as extensive excerpts from Wagner's Tristan and Die Walküre. By 1946, Virgil Thompson wrote that Rudzinski's careful training had made the Philharmonic the equal of the Boston and Philadelphia orchestras and possibly their superior. That same year, the only surviving visual document of Rozhinsky's conducting was preserved in the Hollywood film Carnegie Hall, which told a fictional story connected to the hall, then interrupted it with appearances by celebrated performers. Here, Rozhinsky conducts the Philharmonic in the finale of Beethoven's Fifth Symphony. Despite his success in New York, Rozhinsky was frustrated in securing a long-term contract with the Philharmonic, which he attributed to the machinations of Arthur Judson. In December 1946, he was offered the Chicago Symphony on terms similar to the Philharmonic's, except that Rozhinsky could schedule operatic performances each season. In early February, there was a long meeting with the Philharmonic Board of Directors. Rozhinsky chronicled Judson's interference and told the board it would have to choose between them. Shortly after the meeting ended, Rozhinsky resigned in response. The board notified him that they were releasing him not at the end of the season, as he had asked, but immediately. The story put him on the cover of Time. That autumn, he arrived in Chicago for the opening of the 1947-48 season. Despite his success in reconstructing the orchestra, this time without resorting to mass dismissals, and the enthusiastic response to his programs by audiences and critics alike, highlighted by a Tristan und Isolde with the first post-war American appearance of Kirsten Flogstad, his plans for the orchestra were not to be. 11 months after he was hired, an announcement was made that he would not be re-engaged after the close of the season. The Chicago debacle was followed late in 1948 by Rozhinsky's first heart attack. Signs of cardiac illness had been mounting for years, but were often misdiagnosed. At the same time that his health began to fail, Rozhinsky's career shifted to Europe, with summers in upstate New York at their home in Lake Placid, purchased after the goat farm in the Berkshires had lost its charm. Rozhinsky had notable success in Italy with operas, including, in 1953, the first performance of Prokofiev's War and Peace outside the USSR. In 1954, he resumed recording, this time for Westminster. Sessions in Vienna were followed by more in London. Richard Rozhinsky remembers spending time with his father in those years.
When I was a child, we were extremely close. I mean, if I had the opportunity of playing outside with my friends or spent some time with my father, I generally spent time with him because we talked about absolutely everything, religion, politics, sex, you name it. And he was a wonderful, wonderful father, wonderful mentor. And I could see, you know, how terribly much he was suffering. Of course, by then he was rather a sick person. He had I guess, three or four heart attacks. And uh, was basically one performance and then a matinee to a good rate.
After recording a significant discography for Westminster, Rozhinsky switched to EMI in 1957 for what would be his last recordings, and his first to be issued in stereo on LP. The Dance of the Seven Veils from Strauss's Salome was taped in the spring of 1958. In 1957, Rozhinsky had a great success in Tristan with the youthful Birgit Nilsson as Isolde at the Florence Maggio Musicale. When Carol Fox of the Chicago Lyric Opera dangled the promise of three Tristans with Nilsson and three of Mussorgsky's Boris Godunov, Rozhinsky agreed, despite admonitions from his doctors, to retire. Rozhinsky once said to his wife Halina, "If I am to kill myself, it will be doing what I love, the only thing I know, making music." In October 1958, he left Lake Placid for Chicago and Tristan rehearsals. The three performances were a triumph, but after the third, Rozhinsky was completely spent. Boris had to be canceled, and he was flown to Boston to be cared for at Massachusetts General Hospital's cardiac facility, where he died on the 27th of November 1958, just weeks shy of his 67th birthday.
But he did die in Boston at the Mass General Hospital. His cardiologist was Paul Bentley White, famous cardiologist, who was also a high school nurse doctor. And afterwards, when he did a postmortem and examined my father's heart, the heart was so tremendously damaged. The blockages were so tremendous. He said, "How this man could get up, could even get out of bed, much less put up a concert, is something that just shows unbelievable strength of will and determination."
Whatever injury to his career was caused by his demanding and often tempestuous personality, Artur Rozhinsky's reputation never went into decline after his death, as many of his recordings remained at least intermittently available. Some of the Westminsters were reissued on CD a few years ago, including some of the stereo ones that he wouldn't approve. The Cleveland and New York Philharmonic recordings have appeared on various unauthorized reissues, but no comprehensive collection of them has been made available. Halina Rozhinska's very personal and partisan memoir, Our Two Lives, is the only thing close to a biographical treatment. The persons who worked with Rozhinsky are dying off rapidly. Fortunately, his interpretative gifts survive in his recordings, and the last one we hear brings the closing pages of Isolde's Liebestod, the last music Rozhinsky conducted, recorded in its orchestral version with the Chicago Symphony in 1947. Thank you. thank Seth Winner, Gary Galo, Richard Rodzinski, and Alan Lazitsky at Music Moyle for help in putting this program together. Thank you very much. Are there any questions? He was one of the conductors who came up in the period when Toscanini dominated the conductorial scene. And since he made his career in the United States, he really, until he left for Europe in 1949, he didn't have much of a European presence at all after he left Poland. So he became one of the most interesting, to my way of thinking, one of the most inventive and energizing conductors, but he wasn't interested in the same things. He was interested in more color than Toscanini was, for instance, but not as much as Stokowski was. He was interested in line and vitality in the way of Toscanini, but he knew how to temper it with a flexibility and ability for characterization that was really, in my opinion, quite special. He's one of the forgotten figures, and as I say, the recordings are what keep his reputation alive. And that is, to me, one of the functions of recordings, is to do exactly what they have done for him, because he'd just be a name in a book now, 50 years after his death, were it not for what he left behind. Anyone else? Yes, in the back. That's right, and that's the one thing I couldn't put in this presentation. I couldn't get to the disc in time. I would have loved to have had his voice as well as his the excerpt from the film.
Another question: I have this Weiss book, Our Two Lives, and do you think that's an accurate and appraisal or an accurate description?
She tries. Helena was a very partisan woman, as well as a fascinating woman. Whom I had the pleasure of interviewing when she did the book tour 30 years ago. There's not enough biographical detail about the earlier periods in his life, and she confuses years sometimes, not meaning to, but she does anyway. That's why we need a first-class biographical treatment of Rodzinski. Yes?
The world's greatest music, is there a discography of those?
Yeah, Mike Gray did one. It's in the Ars Journal somewhere.
It was in the early 1980s, like 1983 he did it in the Journal. He also did the World's Greatest Opera, which was a companion series
to that.
Yes, I knew
about that one, yeah.
We have one more question or two rows behind you. Yes.
What was the reasons for his dismissal in Chicago?
They made up, apparently, they claimed he spent too much money, that he changed programs too often. It seems clear that the board of directors in Chicago was happiest when Frederick Stock was on the podium, because he never asked for anything special, I guess. But they simply weren't used to a high-powered conductorial personality like Rodzinski, and they just couldn't swallow it. So since he was, no matter how much, I mean, there was immense controversy in the local press when he was fired. Claudia Cassidy threatened to resign from the Tribune, but Colonel McCormick simply doubled her salary and told her to hit it even harder. Anyone else? Thank you once again.
Thank you, guys.